you know, there's a lot more buyers out there. You know, if there's one seller selling a building, there's going to be 100 people wanting to buy it. So I really encourage people, if they don't already have the experience, you know, to get into it. Or, you know, if you own a 30 unit building and you're trying to buy a 60 unit building from me, you know, we're good to go.
All right, everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Birmingham Real Estate Investor. I'm one of your co-hosts, Spencer Sutton. I've got Matthew Whitaker back with me this week, and we're excited to introduce everybody to Steve Nunnally. And Steve is a director at Berkadia here in Birmingham, and he is involved in multifamily investments. And so, Steve, man, thanks so much for joining us on the podcast.
Yeah, I appreciate you guys. I'm glad to be here.
So Steve works with David Oakley, who we've had as a guest on in the past. And if you haven't heard that episode, you absolutely need to go listen to it. But Steve, tell us a little bit about your background and your history in the real estate business.
Yeah, I got into real estate right around going on 3 years ago. I had been trading agriculture commodities, and I knew a guy, kind of met him through mutual friends, who was a broker doing really well. And I just had always been intrigued by the real estate markets, where you can get a lot of the due diligence done on the front end and kind of protect your investment just by, you know, putting in the hard work. It's just something I really found interesting. And being a broker, I thought, was a really good way to kind of get in and meet the people and learn everything. And it's definitely proven true. I joined, I was offered a job with Berkadia, which was sort of my dream job. I was offered that, and I've been here a couple months now, and really taking my career to the next level. I have a really good team here, David Oakley, who you mentioned earlier. I encourage people also to listen to that podcast. You know, he's a really good mentor of mine, and a really connected person that knows as much as anybody I've met about real estate, all different types.
And one of the things David said about you was, and admired in you, is your hustle. And one of the things I always say is, hustle in real estate gets you a long way. If you're willing to go out and do the work, then, and meet the people and make the connections, that hustle gets you a long way. So I'd love for you to talk a little bit about hustle as it pertains to your growth and kind of the opportunities it's afforded you.
Absolutely. You know, for me, hustle is really just phone calls. And, you know, for the first probably, I mean, it was about a year and a half of making phone calls before I closed my first deal. And, you know, there's everybody in real estate, when they're getting started, unless they have a unlimited, you know, bank account, you're going to have to get out and do things that at times you don't really know if it's paying off. And those phone calls I made, you know, I didn't know if they were paying off. And then they kind of started to pay off. And the same goes for meetings, which is probably the thing I would recommend most, and to myself and others, is to get in front of people physically. And, you know, those phone calls, once you get to know somebody, it really opens the doors to do that. But again, I think that's something everybody that's had to build a career in real estate has had to do, is, you know, just the reps of calls or meetings and things like that, and driving properties and everything. And, can feel like it's not paying off, but it definitely does in time.
Talk about your mindset during that year and a half of making all those phone calls. And then what were you doing for income? So two questions there.
Okay. Yeah, that was a tough year and a half or so. My mindset was, it's just a numbers game, and there's enough people out there that have proven, you know, if you're an intelligent person and you kind of know what you're selling and doing, if you're a likable person, and then if you, you know, again, just have the persistence and the drive to do it. And so I just knew if I kept on doing it long enough, it was, you know, I'd find deals, find financials on deals. That was really my goal, was find financials, you know, get somebody to trust me enough to show me their P&L or their rent roll, you know, on apartments or, you know, it's just, so that's really where I was focused, was just the numbers game. And eventually it would pay off, you know, having meetings especially is what really paid off. And then financially, I was fortunate. I worked 2.5 years as a commodity trader and had saved up money and actually traded, you know, options and things that were really, they were a lot more difficult and stressful than real estate, it seemed like, with big swings up and down. But I had saved up enough, but I mean, it was definitely, you know, I was full commission. So it was watching more money go out than come in. And sink or swim kind of. And I think a lot of people, you know, if they, especially if they quit their job like I did and try to make it in real estate, it actually just lights a little bit of a fire to keep the phones ringing, to keep the meetings being set and everything. So definitely a stressful year. Glad to be past it. And I think, you know, there's probably a lot more people out there in a similar situation. You know, I felt pretty alone at times, but I bet there's a lot of people out there that are in the same situation or considering making the jump.
Yeah, I think, you know, when you are on 100% commission, it definitely lights the fire to get out there and to meet people. So I'd like to know, like, how did these phone calls go? So you're calling people, you're trying to find these multi-unit owners. And then what's your goal? Your goal is to get them to a meeting, to sit down and talk with them, and then to eventually list their property. So how many meetings would it typically take to get that listing?
Right. Ironically, I should have probably done more meetings, but a lot of it was, my mentality was, you know, my goal was to try to just get, you know, on apartment communities, it was just get their rent roll and get their financials. And so I just had to explain to them that, you know, I knew buyers that would be interested, and I wanted to give them a free valuation of what their property was worth. And, you know, if you talk to somebody on the phone and you kind of get along, a lot of times they'll let you have it, you know, just kind of they'll share a file with you, which seems like it would be a lot easier, but you really have to work for it. But a lot of that actually came, I was getting financials without even having met the people. Looking back, I wish I had met more of them to help build that trust level. But, you know, my really goal was, if I sense at all that he wants to sell this property, I need his financials so I can help him find the best buyer for it. And I think they can kind of sense when you really are just trying to help them. If I didn't sense, if they wanted to buy more, you know, I would just make sure I log that this guy's not a seller. But when I find somebody that might be interested, I need to remember this guy. And that's really what my mindset was just building trust and figuring out what they needed. And if that was at all selling, that's, that guy would be flagged and maybe I would try to go meet him.
You've used the word trust a number of times, and I think it's so important in the real estate business as you build a career to have a lot of people trusting you. So talk a little bit about ways to build trust and how you can build value for your potential clients that in turn manifests itself in trust.
My goal really is, like I said, my goal was really get the financials, but at times I realized that the best thing to do is really when your mind really is in helping the person reach their goal, as I mentioned earlier, that's what builds trust. You know, if my mindset really is, how can I help this guy? Maybe I just want to sell his building, but he wants to buy more. So I have to put my mind in my client, you know, and think about what my client really wants and what's going to benefit him the most. You know, there were times that selling his apartment community is what I wanted, but it wasn't ready. You know, it needed new management, and I've recommended management companies I've met and helped them get the management from a potential client. And then, you know, if I recommend the right guys that really do fit and really will make a difference, it's led to listings. So really my number one thing of the reason why my clients trust me is because I really do sit around and brainstorm ways to help them reach their goals, be it selling or making their property more profitable or even just finding more properties. You know, the thing I noticed the days that or the weeks that I'd go in and just want to sell a property or to get financials were less successful than the days I sat around and figured out how can I help these people. And so now it's just become part of my day to day is trying to help people. And it ends up, you know, one way or another, it ends up coming back around and paying off.
Yeah, I think about this and admire you. You know, you could have easily taken the short term gain and focused on just getting a deal done that wasn't in your client's best interest just because you didn't have money rolling in, versus building that trust, taking that time over the long term so that you're building a career in real estate. And I think a lot of people make that mistake when they first get in, is they have the stress of I need money now. And they make a lot of bad decisions and almost ruin the reputation right off the bat. Talk a little bit about, from a mindset standpoint, of how hard that is to stay disciplined, to being trustworthy, so that you can build a long-term career.
Right. I think a lot of it, in a way, can come naturally to certain people. But I always notice if I ever do have an opportunity that can benefit me and not other people, you know, I try to really take a step back and recognize, you know, what am I doing and is that really what I want to do? And, 9 out of 10 times, I truly believe if you just put the other people first, it's going to be a better outcome in the long run. So that's something that just, again, it's part of my day to day. And I think that, you know, and it shows there's definitely people I've met that that's not the case. You know, it's very obvious. And a lot of people, once they find out, don't want to work with those people. You know, I don't want to work with a investor, a buyer that I think is going to try and trick a seller, you know, or because then, you know, he might try to trick me or something, you know. So it's, if you pick up on those things, you know, and if, you know, I think a lot of the industry has a long memory. And if that happens one time, they're going to remember it. And so it's just something to be kind of cautious of. But
tell us about the type deals that you're focusing on now. What types of deals are you doing and, you know, who your clients are?
I'd also like to know maybe even the progression. So you've been doing this for 3 years. How did you start out? Like, what were the type of deals you were doing when you started out? And then even today?
Okay. I started out on really C-class apartment properties, you know, 50 plus units. The first one I actually sold was 120 units and it was in really rough shape, needed a lot of rehab. It was actually under 20,000 per unit, you know, and needed about the same in rehab. So that's where I started just because those properties, not as many brokers were chasing the kind of the ugly ones. And so from that, I then, the same owner owned like 27 units. It was like four different little buildings and sold that, which ended up leading to a few more. Again, these also needed heavy rehab. So it led to a few more kind of similar 30 to 40 unit properties, kind of distressed on most of them. Now that I'm with Bricadia, it is somewhat switched. You know, we right now have a 40 million, a 80 something million, and a over $100 million property. One of them's over 1,000 units. It's the largest in Alabama. So it's definitely switching. I'm kind of getting into a little bit bigger game, but at the same time, it's very interesting to me that, you know, there's clients that are looking and making offers on some of those properties that actually one of them started out in single family, you know, and was buying portfolios as single family. And now here he is making offers on these, you know, massive buildings. So, you know, it's kind of a fluid thing. And I try to, in a way, I really do like where I started. I like the C class. I like the smaller properties. I like kind of undercapitalized assets that maybe not as many brokers are chasing. And again, I also am thankful to be here with Bricadia and selling these, you know, massive communities.
Everybody gets really excited as you're moving up to what I would consider the big leagues in real estate. And so congratulations. But what are some of the things that when you were getting started and now you see from other investors that they do wrong? What are some of the mistakes that they make that are completely avoidable?
I think more so than what they do wrong. You know, everybody has their own business plan, but I think the biggest thing we all could do better is more face-to-face meetings. You know, every one of us says that, but how many of us, especially with COVID, have even had 5 meetings in the last month or so, you know? And so I think that even as a broker, you know, if I meet somebody and he tells me he wants to buy property versus if I talk to, which I talk to probably 100 people a week that want to buy property, the guy that shows up in the office is going to automatically move to the top of mind, top of the list, just because it's natural that I remember him and, you know, if you had lunch or something. So that's the biggest thing I can say is the more, and again, I'm speaking to myself, but the more face-to-face meetings, the better.
Yeah. So also kind of going on that, the opposite, what are the most successful investors that you see today? What are they doing that maybe others aren't doing?
I would say that the most successful guys are, I mean, they definitely are setting the meetings, you know, just keeping their eyes open, staying in contact with brokers. And, you know, we have so many people to talk to. Definitely helps out. If, you know, there's certain clients of mine that they do, if I haven't talked to them in a few weeks, I got busy, they'll give me a call and kind of check on me. You know, they're doing my job for me, making that call. And, you know, it's, you know, that's little things like that really do help. But I don't know if there's like one thing that's really showing the guy, you know, that really makes a difference and that I can note.
Talk a little bit about Birmingham. Let's dig into some areas that you're seeing are very hot right now in Birmingham. Can you just kind of give us a Birmingham overview?
Definitely. You know, I've lived in Birmingham for about 2 months now, so there's definitely going to be of, you know, better market experts. David Oakley would be one of them. But one of the things for my personal business I've been targeting is kind of the outskirts. You know, Center Point is just to the north of Birmingham, about 20 or 30 minutes. And, you know, we have a property up there we're working on, and there's, you know, I like to kind of really target some areas that maybe are in the path of growth and maybe just need, you know, there's some undercapitalized deals that nobody's wanted to take the risk on. You know, you go to the real well-known, you know, Homewoods, Mount Brook, and the Vestavia Hills type areas. Those are kind of the areas that people know what they have. They know their land is valuable, and the asset on top of it's even more valuable. And I think it takes, in a way, it can take away some of the opportunity, is if you can get ahead of some, the Avondale type area, you know, it's kind of becoming, there's breweries and things coming up in that area. I think that's really where I try to go, is places that, that are in the path of growth. And a lot of times the way you find those is just areas that, you know, you can just tell by driving through them, they're a little bit undercapitalized.
Give us some specific areas. You mentioned Center Point, which is northeast of town. What are some other areas that you think are in the path of growth right now?
Well, I think, like I said, Avondale is already in, it's already growing. You know, I've heard good things about Irondale, a little bit more to the east. I haven't personally worked on that area, but it's definitely one that I have kind of as a target.
Talk about when you investors move up from single family to small multifamily, then to large multifamily. Like, what changes in an investor's mindset, in their income? You know, what is it that gets somebody from one plateau to the next?
Right. I know a good amount of guys that are in the single family space. And what I've seen is they'll have 10 or 20 or even over 100 houses to keep track of. And then they can go buy 40 units, 30 or 40 units. I noticed that there's a little bit lower return on the 30 or 40 or 50 unit properties as there might be on a single family house. But there's also what I think they like is less risk. If you have one guy move out of a house, you know, and it takes you 3 months to fill it in, you just lost a quarter of your revenue for the year. Whereas with apartments, you can really kind of fine tune it a little bit, play with rents, and really kind of dial it in to perform at the optimal level. That's on the smaller ones, going from the 100 plus units, because then you can afford to have somebody on the payroll there. And it just makes sense. And you can have maybe a maintenance guy, or at least part-time maintenance guy, or you can get a management company to run it for, say, 6 or 8%, sometimes even lower, if you have kind of a portfolio with them. So it really, you get the economies of scale. And I really do think there's a sweet spot in that 100 plus unit range that the guys really strive to get there. If you get up to the large 300 plus units, you run into a bunch of institutional money and there's sort of like a wall. But if you stay in that, I really think maybe more like 50 to 120 range, you can find a lot of off-market deals or undercapitalized, you know, maybe mom and pop shop type things that need a little work and are large enough to pay the bills for good management and employees if needed.
Let's say I am a potential client of yours and I come to you and I say, you know, I'm really looking for one of these 50 to 120 unit buildings or a series of buildings. What are some questions that you would ask me to make sure that I could perform it? So if somebody's listening to this and they want to get into that, so they can make sure that they check all the boxes.
Right. The biggest thing is everybody wants to own that, but how many people do? And it makes as a broker, it'll make me nervous if you've never done, if you don't own that and you've never gone through that process with the banks and with everything. So, you know, but if you don't already own, I recommend, the key is, it's kind of, we see a lot of guys that kind of team up or they're sort of a partner with somebody. And if you can kind of ride somebody's, get under somebody's wing and get to where, even if you're just a limited partner, as long as you can kind of show you've been through the process or you're going to bring somebody in to help you with that process, that's a huge benefit because, you know, there's a lot more buyers out there than there are, you know, if there's one seller selling a building, there's going to be 100 people wanting to buy it. So I really encourage people, if they don't already have the experience, you know, to get into it, or, you know, if you own a 30 unit building and you're trying to buy a 60 unit building from me, you know, we're good to go. That's kind of a perfect, you've got that done. Now this is just the natural next step. You probably have a little equity in the first one. So, I definitely think single family jumping to apartments, it's going to be, you know, to buy the first 30 or 40 units isn't a big deal. But if you're trying to get into that larger range, you're going to need some type of experience to really buy the credibility.
What type of cash am I going to need to buy one of these properties or balance sheet? What do you look for in a buyer when you're looking to represent one?
Right. Really a lot of, you know, some of the 30 and 40 unit properties I've sold are, I mean, they can be, depending on how much rehab needed, they can be close to $1 million, maybe up to 2 million. So a lot of those are going to have a 75% loan to value. So, I mean, realistically, you know, $300,000-$500,000 of equity is enough to get a lot of these done. So on that smaller range, the kind of first step, that's what you need. You know, you start getting up to the 50 to 120 units, kind of that range, you know, it can be, you might need well over $1 million raise. So if you don't personally have that, you know, it's, you're going to have to kind of show you at least have a group together who does, or, you know, just, or other properties with equity in it is sort of the initial screening.
You also mentioned the close process, that a lot of people get cold feet, it sounds like, during the close process. I'm curious, from the time somebody agrees to a price to the time we close, how long does that take? And what are some issues that if I'm buying one, I should be prepared for when we're going through the diligence process?
Right. The due diligence process is typically we get a letter of intent, and then within about a week we'll have a purchase sale agreement. And then you have around 30 days. Some people will try to push it to 45, which can really hurt, even though that 15 days could help you, it really can hurt you in the eyes of the broker or the seller, because at that point we could get 45 days down the road and you can back out and take your earnest money deposit with you, which can be pretty substantial on some of these deals. So, you know, but you'll have your 30-day due diligence. A lot of times the best thing to do during that is, I mean, you're going to have the bank really guiding a lot of that. They're going to have an appraiser out there for an inspection. We really just recommend letting them handle a lot of that to make sure, you know, you're them and a good property management company are going to be the most beneficial to make sure you really, you know, uncover everything you can. Then typically we have 30 to 60 days after that to close. Again, if you can do it in 30, that always seems to look better to the seller, but a lot of times we do see, you know, 60 days after the expiration of due diligence to close.
And it seems like the market's pretty hot right now and a lot of transactions are taking place. Is that true even in a COVID world? And why do you think so many transactions are taking place if the answer is yes?
I think the answer is yes. And I think that there's enough people that have owned long enough that have ridden this wave of appreciation that are sort of starting to feel maybe like the world's a little bit shaky right now. And the second thing is, you know, the banks definitely had a pause where they really tightened up, you know, in the March, April, May kind of area. But people with long-term relationships with banks or you know, large lines of credit or cash flow, a lot of those guys were able to capitalize on sort of the pause and a little bit of market instability and just keep on writing checks and buying properties. So there's always going to be people out there that are willing to take the risk. And then when things like this happen, it really maybe will scare a couple people into selling as well. So that's sort of what I've seen.
And where are kind of cap rates today? I mean, just give a range. I know it varies based on the building, but where are you seeing cap rates today?
A lot of the properties I sell, especially less than 100 units, and if they need rehab, will be, you know, it can be 6, 7%. Some of the smaller ones are closer to 8. And again, a lot of those, you know, if they do need rehab, you know, there's still a lot of upside in that. So, you know, it might trade for a little lower if it has some obvious, you know, 30% of it's vacant, it might end up trading below a 6 cap, but you're able to just go put 5,000 a unit into those 30% and all of a sudden you're up back closer to 8% equivalent. So But I would say around high sixes is what a lot of the C-class properties I trade are.
Have you seen, just kind of going back to the COVID world, how have collections been in these apartments? I mean, we've noticed we've had the best leasing summer that we've ever had here at GK Houses, but was wondering about in the apartment world what that's looked like this summer.
Good to hear that. And oddly enough, that's been what I've heard from a lot of my clients. It's been, you know, very strong. And I think that's actually driven more dollars towards multifamily is how well it did perform through COVID. I did hear, you know, some really large groups that own all over the country in large cities, maybe like 5% decline in collections. But a lot of that's going to be the A-class large city portfolios and the Nashvilles and I guess, you know, downtown Atlanta, things like that. But, you know, most of my clients, because they're in the trending upward rehabbing stages, have had record years of collections. So it really has not, thankfully, affected us that much.
And this is a Birmingham show, but just for the sake of the audience, you focus on all of Alabama. Tell us what markets that you like to focus on. So if somebody is interested in a market other than Birmingham, what areas would they contact you for?
Right. I used to live in Huntsville. I think the market there is a little bit almost too hot right now. You have too many buyers looking at it. I focus a lot in Mobile, Alabama, along the Gulf Coast. We've had quite a few. We have several under contract and listed down there right now. You know, so I really like that market. Birmingham's a great market. One market I would like to target a little bit more is the Chattanooga, Knoxville area. I really think that there's a lot of opportunity up there. And again, a little bit more along the Gulf Coast. There's some deals we've worked on in Mississippi and kind of the Florida panhandle. But again, most of what I focus on is Mobile, and I think Birmingham's also a great market to get into.
We also have an office in Chattanooga. So, and I agree, Chattanooga's market is really hot right now. A lot of investors are coming out of Nashville, and then a lot of people coming from all over the country to invest there. So if somebody wanted to get in touch with you, what's the best way for them to reach you, Steve?
Best thing would be probably phone call or also my email, which is steve.nunnelly, N-U-N-N-E-L-L-E-Y, at Berkadia.com. And they could also just go on the Berkadia website and search for Birmingham.
Yeah, we'll definitely put the link in the show notes so people can find you. Well,
awesome.
This has been great.
I appreciate that. Definitely.
Nope, Steve, this has been great. I'm impressed with your hot start, and I think you've teamed up with a really cool guy in David Oakley. And, you know, for the people out there that are looking for somebody that'll get out and hustle for them, I think partnering with you or getting you on their team makes a lot of sense. So thank you so much for joining the show.
Definitely. Well, I appreciate that. And thank you guys.
All right, everybody. That's another wrap on an episode of the Birmingham Real Estate Investor. If you haven't subscribed already, go ahead and do that and look for us on the next episode.
And give us a review.